Chapter 24. Were originated only 4 years ago. In the first 6 weeks of the undertaking, the young men of themselves and quite unaided subscribed the large sum of £3,000. The schools have been opened only 3 years. They have now on their foundation 39 children, and in a few days they will have 6 more, making a total of 45. They have been most munificently assisted by the heads of great mercantile houses, numerously represented, I am happy to say, around me, and they have a funded capital of almost £14,000. This is wonderful progress, but the aim must still be upwards, the motto always excelsior. You do not need to be told that 45 children can form but a very small proportion of the orphan and necessitous children of those who have been entrusted with the wholesale trades and manufactures of the United Kingdom. You do not require to be informed that the house at New Cross, rented for a small term of years, in which the schools are at present established, can afford but most imperfect accommodation for such a breadth of design. To carry this good work through the 2 remaining degrees of better and best, there must be more work, more cooperation, more friends, more money. Then be the friends, and give the money. Before I conclude, there is one other feature in these schools which I would commend to your special attention and approval. Their benefits are reserved for the children of subscribers. That is to say, it is an essential principle of the institution that it must help those whose parents have helped them, and that the unfortunate children whose father has been so lax, or so criminal, as to withhold a subscription so exceedingly small that, when divided by weeks it amounts to only 3 pence weekly, cannot, in justice, be allowed to jostle out and shoulder away the happier children, whose father has had that little forethought, or done that little kindness which was requisite to secure for them the benefits of the institution. I really cannot believe that there will long be any such defaulting parents. I cannot believe that any of the intelligent young men who are engaged in the wholesale houses will long neglect this obvious, this easy duty. If they suppose that the objects of their love, born or unborn, will never want the benefits of the charity, that may be a fatal and blind mistake. It can never be an excuse, for, supposing them to be right in their anticipation, they should do what is asked for the sake of their friends and comrades around them, assured that they will be the happier and the better for the deed. Ladies and gentlemen, this little labor of love of mine is now done. I most heartily wish that I could charm you now not to see me, not to think of me, not to hear me. I most heartily wish that I could make you see in my stead the multitude of innocent and bereaved children who are looking towards these schools and entreating with uplifted hands to be let in. A very famous advocate once said, in speaking of his fears of failure, when he had first to speak in court, being very poor, that he felt his little children tugging at his skirts, and that recovered him. Will you think of the number of little children who are tugging at my skirts, when I ask you, in their names, on their behalf, and in their little persons, and in no strength of my own, to encourage and assist this work? At a later period of the evening, Mr. Dickens proposed the health of the president of the institution, Lord John Russell. He said he should do nothing so superfluous and so unnecessary as to descant upon his lordship's many faithful, long, and great public services, upon the honor and integrity with which he had pursued his straightforward public course through every difficulty, or upon the manly, gallant, and courageous character which rendered him certain, in the eyes alike of friends and opponents, to rise with every rising occasion, and which, like the seal of Solomon, in the old Arabian story, enclosed in a not very large casket the soul of a giant. In answer to loud cheers, he said he had felt perfectly certain that that would be the response, for in no English assembly that he had ever seen was it necessary to do more than mention the name of Lord John Russell, to ensure a manifestation of personal respect and grateful remembrance. Speech. London, May 8, 1858. The 48th anniversary of the establishment of the Artists' Benevolent Fund took place on the above date at the Freemasons' Tavern. The chair was taken by Mr. Charles Dickens, who, after having disposed of the preliminary toasts with his usual felicity, proceeded to advocate the claims of the institution in whose interest the company had assembled, in the following terms. Ladies and gentlemen, there is an absurd theatrical story which was once told to me by a dear and valued friend, who has now passed from this sublunary stage, and which is not without its moral as applied to myself, in my present presidential position. In a certain theatrical company was included a man, who on occasions of emergency was capable of taking part in the whole round of the British drama, provided he was allowed to use his own language in getting through the dialogue. It happened one night that Reginald, in the Castle Spectre, was taken ill, and this veteran of 100 characters was, of course, called up for the vacant part. He responded with his usual promptitude, although knowing nothing whatever of the character, but while they were getting him into the dress, he expressed a not unreasonable wish to know in some vague way what the part was about. He was not particular as to details, but in order that he might properly portray his sufferings, he thought he should have some slight inkling as to what really had happened to him. As, for example, what murders he had committed, whose father he was, of what misfortunes he was the victim, in short, in a general way, to know why he was in that place at all. They said to him, "Here you are, chained in a dungeon, an unhappy father. You have been here for 17 years, during which time you have never seen your daughter. You have lived upon bread and water, and, in consequence, are extremely weak, and suffer from occasional lowness of spirits." "All right," said the actor of universal capabilities, "ring up." When he was discovered to the audience, he presented an extremely miserable appearance, was very favorably received, and gave every sign of going on well, until, through some mental confusion as to his instructions, he opened the business of the act by stating in pathetic terms that he had been confined in that dungeon 17 years, during which time he had not tasted a morsel of food, to which circumstance he was inclined to attribute the fact of his being at that moment very much out of condition. The audience, thinking this statement exceedingly improbable, declined to receive it, and the weight of that speech hung round him until the end of his performance. Now I too have received instructions for the part I have the honor of performing before you, and it behoves both you and me to profit by the terrible warning I have detailed, while I endeavor to make the part I have undertaken as plain and intelligible as I possibly can. As I am going to propose to you that we should now begin to connect the business with the pleasure of the evening by drinking prosperity to the Artists' Benevolent Fund, it becomes important that we should know what that fund is. It is an association supported by the voluntary gifts of those who entertain a critical and admiring estimation of art, and has for its object the granting of annuities to the widows and children of deceased artists of artists who have been unable in their lives to make any provision for those dear objects of their love surviving themselves. Now it is extremely important to observe that this institution of an Artists' Benevolent Fund, which I now call on you to pledge, has connected with it, and has arisen out of another artists' association, which does not ask you for a health, which never did, and never will ask you for a health, which is self-supporting, and which is entirely maintained by the prudence and providence of its 300 artist members. That fund, which is called the Artists' Annuity Fund, is, so to speak, a joint and mutual assurance company against infirmity, sickness, and age. To the benefits it affords every one of its members, as an absolute right, a right, be it remembered, produced by timely thrift and self-denial, and not assisted by appeals to the charity or compassion of any human being. On that fund there are, if I remember aright, some 17 annuitants who are in the receipt of $1,100 a year, the proceeds of their own self-supporting institution. and recommending to you this benevolent fund, which is not self-supporting, they address you, in effect, in these words. We ask you to help these widows and orphans, because we show you we have first helped ourselves. These widows and orphans may be ours or they may not be ours. But in any case, we will prove to you to a certainty that we are not so many wagoners calling upon Jupiter to do our work, because we do our own work. Each has his shoulder to the wheel. Each, from year to year, has had his shoulder set to the wheel, and the prayer we make to Jupiter and all the gods is simply this, that this fact may be remembered. When the wagon has stopped forever, and the spent and worn-out wagoner lies lifeless by the roadside. Ladies and gentlemen, I most particularly wish to impress on you the strength of this appeal. I am a painter, a sculptor, or an engraver, of average success. I study and work here for no immense return, while life and health, while hand and eye are mine. I prudently belong to the annuity fund, which in sickness, old age, and infirmity, preserves me from want. I do my duty to those who are depending on me while life remains, but when the grass grows above my grave there is no provision for them any longer. This is the case with the Artists' Benevolent Fund, and in stating this, I am only the mouthpiece of 300 of the trade, who in truth stands as independent before you, as if they were 300 cockers all regulated by the gospel according to themselves. There are in existence 3 artists' funds, which ought never to be mentioned without respect. I am an officer of one of them, and can speak from knowledge. But on this occasion I address myself to a case for which there is no provision. I address you on behalf of those professors of the fine arts who have made provision during life, and in submitting to you their claims I am only advocating principles which I myself have always maintained. When I add that this benevolent fund makes no pretensions to gentility, squanders no treasure in keeping up appearances, that it considers that the money given for the widow and the orphan should really be held for the widow and the orphan, I think I have exhausted the case, which I desire most strenuously to commend to you. Perhaps you will allow me to say one last word. I will not consent to present to you the professors of art as a set of helpless babies, who are to be held up by the chin. I present them as an energetic and persevering class of men, whose incomes depend on their own faculties and personal exertions. And I also make so bold as to present them as men who in their vocation render good service to the community. I am strongly disposed to believe there are very few debates in Parliament so important to the public welfare as a really good picture. I have also a notion that any number of bundles of the driest legal chaff that ever was chopped would be cheaply expended for one really meritorious engraving. At a highly interesting annual festival at which I have the honor to assist, and which takes place behind 2 fountains, I sometimes observe that great ministers of state, and other such exalted characters have a strange delight in rather ostentatiously declaring that they have no knowledge whatever of art, and particularly of impressing on the company that they have passed their lives in severe studies. It strikes me when I hear these things, as if these great men looked upon the arts as a sort of dancing dogs, or punches show, to be turned to for amusement, when one has nothing else to do. Now I always take the opportunity on these occasions of entertaining my humble opinion, that all this is complete bosh, and of asserting to myself my strong belief, that the neighborhoods of Trafalgar Square, or Suffolk Street, rightly understood, are quite as important to the welfare of the empire as those of Downing Street, or Westminster Hall. Ladies and gentlemen, on these grounds, and backed by the recommendation of 300 artists in favor of the Benevolent Fund, I beg to propose its prosperity as a toast for your adoption. Speech. The Farewell Reading. St. James Hall, March 15, 1870. With the Christmas Carol and the Trial from Pickwick, Mr. Charles Dickens brought to a brilliant close the memorable series of public readings which have for 16 years proved to audiences unexampled in numbers, the source of the highest intellectual enjoyment. Every portion of available space in the building was, of course, last night occupied some time before the appointed hour. But could the St. James Hall have been specially enlarged for the occasion to the dimensions of Salisbury Plain, it is doubtful whether sufficient room would even then have been provided for all anxious to seize the last chance of hearing the distinguished novelist give his own interpretation of the characters called into existence by his own creative pen. As if determined to convince his auditors that, whatever reason that influenced his determination, physical exhaustion was not amongst them, Mr. Dickens never read with greater spirit and energy. His voice to the last retained its distinctive clearness, and the transitions of tone, as each personage in the story, conjured up by a word, rose vividly before the eye, seemed to be more marvelous than ever. The vast assemblage, hushed into breathless attention, suffered not a syllable to escape the ear, and the rich humor and deep pathos of one of the most delightful books ever written found once again the fullest appreciation. The usual burst of merriment responsive to the blithe description of Bob Cratchit's Christmas Day, and the wonted sympathy with the crippled child Tiny Tim, found prompt expression, and the general delighted hearing of Ebenezer Scrooge's reformation was only checked by the saddening remembrance that with it the last strain of the carol was dying away. After the trial from Pickwick, in which the speeches of the opposing counsel, and the owlish gravity of the judge, seemed to be delivered and depicted with greater dramatic power than ever, the applause of the audience rang for several minutes through the hall, and when it had subsided, Mr. Dickens, with evidently strong emotion, but in his usual distinct and expressive manner, spoke as follows. Ladies and gentlemen, it would be worse than idle, for it would be hypocritical and unfeeling, if I were to disguise that I close this episode in my life with feelings of very considerable pain. For some 15 years, in this hall and in many kindred places, I have had the honor of presenting my own cherished ideas before you for your recognition, and, in closely observing your reception of them, have enjoyed an amount of artistic delight and instruction which, perhaps, is given to few men to know. In this task, and in every other I have ever undertaken, as a faithful servant of the public, always imbued with a sense of duty to them, and always striving to do his best, I have been uniformly cheered by the readiest response, the most generous sympathy, and the most stimulating support. Nevertheless, I have thought it well, at the full flood tide of your favor, to retire upon those older associations between us, which date from much further back than these, and henceforth to devote myself exclusively to the art that first brought us together. Ladies and gentlemen, in but 2 short weeks from this time I hope that you may enter, in your own homes, on the new series of readings, at which my assistance will be indispensable. 23, but from these garish lights I vanish now forevermore, with a heartfelt, grateful, respectful, and affectionate farewell. Amidst repeated acclamations of the most enthusiastic description, whilst hats and handkerchiefs were waving in every part of the hall, Mr. Charles Dickens retired, withdrawing with him one of the greatest intellectual treats the public ever enjoyed. Speech. The Newsvendors' Institution, London, April 5, 1870. The annual dinner in aid of the funds of the Newsvendors' Benevolent and Provident Institution was held on the above evening. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.